Welcome to our third presentation on stocks, and in this presentation we will take a look at some various stock characteristics and introduce probably the most important measurement, stock measure that we will discuss in detail as we go through the next several chapters. So let's start on slide number 61, stock spinoff. This is a conversion of one of a firm's subsidiaries to a standalone company by distribution of stock in that new company to existing shareholders. So for some reason, the company feels that a part of the company would be better off on its own. Sometimes the new company is still majority owned by the company that spun it off. So a few years back, Kraft was part of Philip Morris, which is now called Altria, and they decided Kraft would be better off on its own. So they spun it off. They sold a part of the Philip Morris empire, Miller Beer, to a South African company, and now they still are involved, so they still own quite a bit of shares of that. It's called SAB Miller. And then they divested themselves of their international tobacco business, which is called Philip Morris International. And that's a real interesting company. It's based in the United States, but sells all of its products outside the United States. So how do you categorize that? And by the way, most all those companies are doing very well. In fact, Kraft broke itself apart into the snacks division, which is called Mondelez, I think now, the Oreos company and the Nabisco and all that. And then the company that sells the cheese and the Oscar Mayer's, that's still called Kraft. I figured these out. The history of spinoffs have been checkered. Some spinoffs have done better than the companies that spun them off. Examples of this are the Baby Bells that were spun off from AT&T back in 1984. Exactly. They started to merge one, and they started to gobble each other up until finally there were two, Verizon, which used to be Bell Atlantic, and AT&T. Wait a minute. SBC Communications got so big that they turned around and bought the old AT&T. Now they call themselves the new AT&T. Some spinoffs didn't do so well. Coca-Cola Enterprises, which was spun off from Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is the company that makes the syrup, makes the soda. Coca-Cola Enterprises bottles the soda. And for some reason they thought that it would go off on its own and do well, and it turned out it didn't do well. And Lucent Technologies. Oh boy, we'll discuss them later on. They were spun off from AT&T. Your grandparents knew them as Western Electric and Bell Labs. They were the company, they still are the company, that built the best telephone equipment in the world, but they made some very bad decisions in the internet bubble and the tech run-up in the late 90s. They didn't do so well. Another company was, you might have heard of them, they're called Yum Brands. Was spun off from Pepsi-Cola. Yum Brands? Yeah, I want you to... They're in part of the assignment, and they're an interesting company. You know who they are. You'll figure out eventually who they are once you... Oh, I know who this company is, right? But what a silly name, Yum. But they've done pretty darn well, and Pepsi still owns quite a bit of the stock. Slide 62, stock split. This is a maneuver in which a company increases the number of shares outstanding by exchanging a specified number of new shares of stock for each outstanding share. So, huh? Well, you had 100 shares, and if it's a 2-for-1 split, you now have 200 shares. Yippee! I got 200 shares! But the price went from $20 down to $10. You see, there's no increased value from stock splits. If you had one share at $20, now you have two shares at $10. The value is still $200. It is a psychological increase at best. We've discussed Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, and we'll talk about them in detail more as we go along. He's the Sage of Omaha, he's called. Very, very successful investor. And he's always thought that splitting stock was an accounting gimmick. Well, there was a reason to split stock, technologically wise, when people were doing 100-share increments and round lots. But now it's not important. Now it's not important. But Warren Buffett said, it's a gimmick. It's not something I want to be a part of. And since the 1960s, he's never split these shares. So a single share now goes for over $169,000. And you say, well, he's done pretty well. But the same thing is true if companies like Coke, like Johnson & Johnson, had never split their stocks, GE. They would be going for thousands of dollars. So you say, well, how am I ever going to buy a share of Berkshire Hathaway? Well, you're not. But there are companies that will sell you 0.001 shares, kind of like a mutual fund of Berkshire Hathaway, you see. So if you have a couple thousand dollars, you can buy whatever that, divide 169 by little bitty pieces, and you can buy so many shares of it. So it's really, it's all accounting. But remember, if you have a two-for-one split, the number of shares doubles, the price goes down in half. There are three-for-one splits, three-for-two splits. There are what are called reverse splits. One for five or one for ten, you had five shares, and now they now have one share. But the price will go up by a factor of five. Sometimes I've seen companies split their shares when they thought things were doing well. And so they didn't want to tell people, you know what, we think things are doing great, buy our shares. Because then if it doesn't turn out to be good, they can get sued. So instead, they'll split the shares as a way of saying, you know, we really are excited about our future prospects. But not having to say that and opening themselves up to the attack lawyers. Slide 63, Treasury stock. Treasury stock, not the United States Treasury. This is shares of stock that have been sold and subsequently repurchased by the issuing firm. They're called share buybacks or buybacks. They reduce the number of outstanding shares. And you economic students will say, oh, yeah, right. Less supply. If the demand doesn't change, what should happen? The price should rise. The logic being that after the buyback, there is less supply of outstanding stock, and existing shareholders now have a larger percentage ownership of the corporation. During the run-up of the 1990s, share buybacks were often seen as a better alternative to dividend increases. The belief was that investors were more interested in capital gains than dividends, and that buybacks increased the potential for capital gains by reducing the supply of stock. It doesn't make sense to buy back your shares if the price is high. But this is what people were wanting. They were wanting to buy high, sell higher, so they were signaling to the company that don't pay us dividends, buy back your shares, and that'll make our shares worth more, and we can make money in the short term. Yeah, you can tell I'm not that big a fan of buying back shares. Sure, if you don't have anything to do with that cash, you can buy back your shares, or why not pay good dividends? Yeah, well, that's everybody's different, folks. Slide 64, classified common stock. Companies, once they get large enough, will often issue various classes of common stock, each of which offers different privileges, different benefits to its holders. There'll be Class A, Class B, Class C. I think one time GM had seven different classes. Some of the classes are just for the family, and they pay good dividends, but they don't really have any voting shares, and the family just wants to, you know, to make money and live off of those shares. For example, Berkshire Hathaway. Well, we already discussed the original shares. They're selling for over $169,000 each. The financial world pressed Warren Buffett, about 20 years ago, to offer a lower cost version of his stock. And so he said, all right, I'll create Class B. But he didn't price them the way they He's a bit of a curmudgeon. You know what that word means, curmudgeon? He's a bit of a cantankerous, an ornery fellow. So he initially sold the Class B shares for around $1,160. And then they went up somewhere around $3,000 or $4,000. And in the prospectus, Buffett said he wouldn't buy them. So he's basically saying, don't buy my shares. Who does that? Well, he didn't want to put them in the first place. But recently what they did is they split them 40 for one. And there's a reason for this. It allows Berkshire Hathaway, his company, to use the Class B shares almost like cash when they buy other companies. So now they sell the Class B shares for around $112. They're similar to the A shares, except they cost a lot less, and you don't get as much you don't get as much prestige owning the B shares. If you own an A share, well, then, yeah. Slide number 65, the par value. You know, no one's ever really explained to me what this par value really means. It's the stated or face value of a stock. And it's sometimes a dollar, sometimes it's a penny. It reminds me of the coupons for manufacturer cents off. What people will do sometimes is they'll send in the dollar off coupon and say, okay, give me my dollar. And the company goes, no, that's not how it works. And the person says, well, it says it's worth a dollar. No, it's worth a dollar if you buy one of the products. So on the back, it'll say, oh, face value, 0.01 cent or something like that. So if you send them 1,000, you get a buck. So I think it's fairly meaningless. However, the book value is very important. And it's one of the things I'm going to ask you to research in the Chapter 5 assignment. That's an accounting calculation. Now, we don't have to do the calculation, folks. That's what they do in the accounting class. But it's the amount of shareholders' equity in a firm. Now, what does that mean? Well, the accountants go and look at all the firm's assets on the books. That's why it's called book value. And they subtract all the firm's liabilities and any preferred stock that they have. And that gives you the book value, the shareholders' equity. What a single share would be worth if you liquidated all the assets, paid off all the debts, and walked away. What would you get? The market value, of course, is what it's selling for. Now, very, very rarely is the book value close to the market value. And we'll discuss this in detail more in Chapter 6. But you're going to look up the market value and the book value, and don't worry about the par value. Slide 66, dividends. Oh, boy, let's start talking about dividends, one of my favorite topics. These are shares of earnings given to stockholders. Normally, in the United States and all the countries that originally were associated with the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Hong Kong, South Africa, they are paid quarterly. Other parts of the world pay them every 6 months, semi-annually, or annually. Are they mandatory? No. Every quarter, the board of directors could say, you know what, we've been paying dividends for the last 50 years, but we're not going to pay them next month, next quarter. Now, do you think that's going to happen? It happens sometimes, but mostly, once a company starts paying dividends, they will continue to do so. In fact, some companies have been growing their dividends for decades, and they've turned out to be some of the market's best performers over time. Dividends are usually a percentage of the earnings per share. Earnings per share is the amount of annual earnings available to common stockholders, as stated on a per share basis. So in other words, how much is each share earning? In the United States, companies tend to avoid ever cutting their dividend. Other countries, they set a percentage of their earnings, and that's what they pay. So it goes up and down. But in the United States, it's almost, with not all companies, a lot of companies don't even pay dividends, but it's almost become a compact. Once they start paying that dividend, or if they increase the dividend, they never want to drop the dividend. And we'll see that sometimes happens when companies hit on hard times when we get to Chapter 6. in the case of General Electric. Slide 67. Here's an earnings per share example. The company reports a net profit of $1 million. Now, is that a lot of money? Well, I don't know. It's a lot of money to you and me, but to a company, yeah. What you have to do is you have to look at how many shares are outstanding. So if the company has 500,000 shares outstanding, that would be $1 million of earnings divided by 500,000 shares, or $2 of earnings per share. So that means every share you own is earning $2. See, it allows you to think of your shares as little bitty machines or little bitty companies. The board of directors might decide to pay out 50% of the earnings in the form of dividends. So, therefore, each shareholder would receive $1 dividend for each share they owned. Now, remember, they pay quarterly, so in reality, they're going to be paying you 25 cents every 3 months. That's how it works out. But in some countries, no, they only pay once a year, or they pay twice a year. That percentage is called the dividend payout ratio. So if the company decides to pay out 50% of their earnings in the form of dividends, they're going to wind up paying 50% of $2 or a dollar. Make sense? Yeah, it does. And there's a worksheet number 2, that I want you to go through. We would go through it together in the face-to-face class. There's a commentary and an answer key. So, the dividend yield, slide 68, very important statistic. This is a measure that relates the dividends to the share price and puts stock dividends on a relative percentage basis rather than an absolute dollar basis. It allows us to compare our stocks to savings accounts or bonds, other income-oriented vehicles. If a stock in the previous slide that we were discussing was paying a dollar dividend, if it were selling for $20, we would take the dollar dividend divided by the $20 price, and that dividend yield would be 5%. Make sense? Now, that's pretty high by today's standards, but some companies are paying it. Traditionally, 3 to 6% was normal. In the 1990s and 1980s and 1990s in the great run-up, dividends went down to 2% or less. In March of 2000, the peak of March of 2000, dividends were 1%. In the turmoil of 2008-09, dividends went up above 3%, and the 10-year Treasury bond went way down below 3%, and now dividends are about 2% or so. They're about back down to about 2%. Slide number 69, some important dates. And I want you to learn this. I know it's a little tedious, but it's something to understand because a lot of people don't really understand what's going on when it comes to how their dividends are being paid. But the board of directors will declare a dividend. That's the declaration date. They don't pay it that day. They just say, oh, next quarter, if it's a United States company or company based in some country associated with the United Kingdom. In the next quarter, we're going to pay this amount. If it's another company based in another country, they might say next year, you know, we're going to pay this amount. And if you want to have this dividend, you have to own the shares by the date of record. That's the date on which an investor must be a registered shareholder of the firm to actually be entitled to receive the dividend. Now, here's where it gets tricky. Ex-dividend date is 3 days before the date of record. If you don't buy the shares by the ex-dividend date, you will not get the dividend because you will not be a shareholder on the date of record. Why is that? Because stock transactions clear in 3 days. We discussed that a little bit when we talked about mutual funds. Mutual funds clear in 1 day. Open-ended mutual funds, you know, closed-end and ETFs work like stocks. So in order to get that dividend, we have to buy the shares by the ex-dividend date so that we are a shareholder on the date of record. The payment date is the day that they actually pay it, which is, you know, a few weeks after the date of record. So you don't get the money right that day. So, slide number 70. We're going to discuss this. I already explained it, but let's do it again. Slide number 70. Why is the ex-dividend date 3 days before the date of record? Because stock transactions close in 3 days. If you purchase a stock on June 15th, assuming that's, you know, Monday or Tuesday, you do not actually get the stock until June 18th. See, boom, boom, boom. It takes 3 days. It used to take 5 days. It used to take a whole week in, you know, because of, you know, no transactions occur on Saturday or Sunday. Theoretically, on the ex-dividend date, the opening share price should reflect a drop in price commensurate with the amount of the dividend. Huh? Well, what that means is if there's a dollar per share dividend that they've declared, the opening stock price should be reduced by a dollar because they're taking a dollar out of their pocket and giving it all to the shareholders. Now, of course, it never works that way. Why? Because the market price is changing all the time and prices are changing all the time. So don't expect that to actually happen. But in mutual funds, it does happen. When they declare a dividend, declare capital gains, the price, open-end mutual funds, drops commensurate with the amount of the dividend or the capital gain. Slide number 71. Don't buy the dividend. Well, you'll hear people say this. It's a common saying in the industry. And the translation means you are better off waiting until the ex-dividend date before buying a stock. Why? Dividends are taxable transactions. If you buy the dividend, in other words, you buy the stock just before the ex-dividend date, you will be responsible for paying the tax on the dividends. Plus, presumably, the stock price will fall commensurate with the amount of the dividend, so you're better off waiting until after the ex-dividend date so that you will get the stock at a better price and not generate a taxable transaction. Maybe this is important for people putting in a ton of money at a time, but for most of us retail investors, it's not that important, assuming you are in it for the long term. Now, here is something that actually harkens back to mutual funds. Mutual funds typically will announce their capital gains in December. They'll usually pay them in December. So at the end of the year, sometimes people, if they put in a tremendous, a lot of money into a mutual fund, and then the mutual fund generates a dividend, generates a large capital gain, they get a 1099 in January saying, you owe us taxes, and you're saying, what? I just put the money in there. So that's something that you might want to keep in mind if you're putting a large sum at one time into the market. But if you're putting $50, $100 in, especially if you're putting it into a 401k or a Roth IRA, then it doesn't matter at all. You don't have to worry about this. But you should be aware of this this phenomenon of buying the dividend. But for most of us, it's not an issue. Slide 72. Now, this is an issue. The different types of dividends. Cash dividends. You want cash dividends. This is a payment in the form of cash. And this is the typical way you're going to get paid by companies. Most all bona fide companies are going to pay you in cash. Some companies might say, hey, we're going to give you a stock dividend. We're going to pay you a dividend in the form of additional shares of stock. Well, this is kind of like a stock split, folks. They're not really giving you anything. All else being equal, stock dividends have no value because they constitute a dilution of ownership. What? Yeah. Let's read this example. If the board of directors declares a 10% stock dividend, for every 10 shares you own, you're going to receive one extra share. But correspondingly, the price of the shares will drop 10% because they've just increased the amount of shares out by 10%. Nothing else changes, and of course, things are changing all the time. But if nothing else changes, they increase the supply of shares like a stock split, then you students of economics will tell us the supply has gone up, the price is going to go down. However, unlike a cash dividend, a stock dividend is not taxed. Whoopee! Thank you, IRS! They're not giving me anything. Isn't it nice of you not to tax it? Right. Thank you very much for not taxing me for something that's not worth anything. And that's exactly what they do with a cash dividend. Oh, yes. They will tax you on a cash dividend because you're actually getting something in your pocket. So make sure you know this important difference. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky. Slide 73. The dividend reinvestment plan is a situation where your shares, when they generate a cash dividend, are automatically reinvested in additional shares. Now, these are not shares that are being issued by the company. These are shares that are out there in the secondary marketplace. So you're actually getting something. There's no dilution of ownership. So this is a taxable transaction, but this is very cool. Dividend reinvestment plans, and don't you just love, they're called DRIPs. On the website is an example of a DRIP and a commentary. They are an excellent way to own stock for those who are interested in long-term growth and not interested in current income. This allows the investor to take advantage of compounding automatically with normally no or very, very small transaction costs. Investing in a company like General Electric, Johnson & Johnson, in this way is almost like investing in a mutual fund. Because this is what your mutual fund will do. It will automatically reinvest your dividends and any capital gains that they issue in additional shares. And this is what the dividend reinvestment plan is. So don't confuse it with a stock dividend. The stock dividend, they are issuing more shares. No. How does it work in practice? Well, GE doesn't do it. They hire some other company to do it for them. And you deal with that company. And that company, when GE pays the dividends, goes out to the secondary marketplace, goes out to the stock market, and buys more shares, and then gives you, you know, little fractional pieces. And you'll see that in the San Diego Gas and Electric, Sempra, example on the website. All right? Very cool. So make sure you understand the difference between cash dividends and share dividends, and how a dividend reinvestment plan works. Dividend reinvestment plans are for long-term dividend-oriented investors. Buy and sell traders and speculators will just kind of poo-poo and say, ugh, I don't want that stuff. But I do. I like it. Me, I like it. 74. Let's end with an introduction, a formal introduction, to a very important statistic. Some might say the most watched stock market statistic and stock statistic, and that's called the price-to-earnings ratio, the P-E. You'll see it written as P/E and sometimes just P-E. It's a very simple calculation. You take the stock price and you divide it by the earnings. So going back to our previous example, a $20 stock price, $2 earnings per share, we take $20 divided by $2, $20 price divided by $2 earnings, and we get 10 price to earnings ratio. Don't put dollar sign, don't percent sign, it's unitless. So is 10 high? Is it low? Well, traditionally, stocks sold for PE ratios of 5 to 14. A PE of 20 was only reserved for the fastest growing stocks. But for many years, at different times, in the 1920s and the 1960s, and then in the 1980s and 90s, PEs of 20 were not unusual. They were sometimes poo-pooed as too low. Yeah, some of them were just to the moon. In the 2008 turmoil, right, when the prices fell dramatically, so did the PE ratios. And we will spend a great deal of time learning about PE and other valuation techniques in the next few chapters. PE is subtle, folks. PE is very subtle. Okay, now go back over. Make sure you understand these characteristics. In our final presentation, we will take a look at different stock types and some stock strategies. Make sure you do worksheet number 2, which will have these calculations on it, and ask you a few questions from about stock markets in general. Okay, see you in our next and last stock introduction to stocks presentation.